October 31st, 2006. We're in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Joan Craig. Our cameraman today is Randy Brewer from Natick Pegasus, our local access station. And we're privileged to have with us today Joseph E. Downey. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. May I ask you when you were born?
When? I was born on Christmas Day in 1919, December 25th.
And where? Where were you born?
In Boston, Roxbury area.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Natick because my mother and father came here when I was very young, maybe 6 months or something like that. And we settled in East Natick, and we grew up over on Oak Street in East Natick.
What was it like back when you were younger in Natick?
There wasn't a great deal of excitement, to tell the truth. Our primary school was right down the end of Oak Street from our house. We really never had to, there weren't any sidewalks, but we didn't, there weren't any cars either. So we were able to walk down the street and go to school from 1 through 6th grades.
Was that the East School?
East Natick School.
East Natick School, which is no longer, correct?
I don't know what it's being used for today. Mm-hmm. I guess it's had a myriad of uses, something to do with calisthenics and bodybuilding, but I think that's changed now.
So it was a wooden structure?
No, it was brick on the outside and wooden.
Is it the school that's now on the corner of Oak Street?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the East Natick School, okay. And did you go to Natick High School?
I did.
And where was that?
That was right across the street. The building is no longer, but it's where the town office building is now.
Right. And what was it like in your high school years? Were you into sports or academics or both?
Well, there was a choice, I guess, when I was in high school as to whether you would pursue a business kind of an education or preparatory for college. And I took the latter, although the money situation and the economics in most families did not allow for college, because I graduated right in the middle of the very long and taxing depression. And I think I graduated in 37. And it was almost impossible to find work or a job or to make plans to go to college, because my parents really did not have the funds and there weren't the scholarships around, that at least I was not aware of one.
What did your dad do?
Big man.
What did your dad do for work?
My father worked for the telephone company, and he had a good job, and it was all through the depression, and we relished the fact that we were one of the few families on the street that really did not receive big bags of oranges and potatoes and things like that from a welfare group, although there were many great families that did. But we didn't, because my father had steady work all through the Depression. And I remember we were one of the first families in that area that had a radio. And it was a big square box with tubes, I guess, then. And when you turned it on, you had to be patient, because it would not come on right away. And the name of the radio was Atwater Kent. And I think after the man that had invented that particular thing became enormously wealthy from it.
Do you remember sitting around the radio, and did neighbors come in also to listen to the news and other?
Particularly at World Series time. As boys, we'd run home from school and tune in the games, and we'd sit by the open window, and so would two or three of our neighbors sit with us. It was a lot of fun, and the families were very close together. I mean, you knew everybody on the street.
Sure.
And you knew all the children. It isn't like today.
And you still live in Natick today?
I do.
So have you lived here all your life?
For that reason, I've come under scrutiny many times from some of my friends in the service when they would repeatedly call me a townie because I had been in the same, basically the same location, but moving around, of course.
Sure, sure. And you live in Natick, and are you married?
Yes.
You're married, and do you have children?
I have two children that are living, two boys. Joe, the oldest boy, is probably 52 or 53, and Brian, the second boy, is just a couple of years younger. They're wonderful kids. I call them kids, but of course they now have their own family, and they live in, Joe lives in Plymouth, and Brian lives in Lexington, respectively. And the kids, they in turn have four sons between them. And the accomplishments that those kids have made, really, in education and sports and music, it's phenomenal.
I can tell you're a very proud grandfather.
I'm very proud of them.
That's wonderful. When did you consider entering the military?
When did I consider getting in?
Yes.
Well, it seems there was a stretch in time there in the early 40s when people were going off in the service, and our playmates became more and more deleted. We couldn't seem to get up enough young men to have a hockey game or something. And my brother Jack was, we had three boys in our family, Jack and myself and Benny. And the other two boys were already in the service. Jack was in some kind of a forward artillery, and Benny, I think, was building runways down in Bermuda. So I was left as the last son of the family, and I said, I've got to do something and get going. I want to be part of this.
Now, you say early 40s. You graduated from high school in the late 30s, and you said it was difficult to get a job. Did you work at the time?
It was almost impossible. I worked for a year with a lot of other Natick boys down at Lookout Farm in South Natick.
Really? Yeah.
But we were just doing, like laborers, weeding and planting. But it was rewarding physically, I remember. I went from kind of an underweight little sibling to somebody a little stronger and huskier, and it was pleasant.
When you made the decision to join the branch of service, what branch did you choose and why?
I chose the Air Force simply because I had kind of looked at the other branches as not with a great deal of knowledge, but I knew that the infantry and the army were marchers and plodders, and it wouldn't be as interesting as it would be to become a cadet. And that's what I did.
And you joined the Air Force. Did other friends or family members join with you, or did you join by yourself?
It's hard to believe this, but The way that we really joined the Air Force was, you got a letter. Well, to begin with, you had to have 2 years of college to become a cadet, or answer the greater part of 150 questions, which were a lot of math and current events and geography and simple. And I happened to be going to some kind of a night school at the time, so I kind of lucked out of that, because I did not have any college.
Do you remember where you were going to night school?
I think it was in near, it wasn't Wentworth, but it was someplace like that. And we used to study a lot of police and fire exams. Mm-hmm. And maybe they had an inkling that we were getting ready to take some kind of an exam to get in the service, and therefore they concentrated on that.
So you joined the Air Force, and you then, did you, your friends did not join with you? I wasn't clear on that.
It's almost unbelievable, but when I was in high school, one of my classmates was Mary Keating, and she had a brother, Jimmy. Jimmy is still part of the central part of Natick, and he still works for Fair and Eager Insurance, I believe. He's one of my best friends, but I didn't know him that well when I went in the service. And it's the strangest thing. We got a letter in the mail telling us to report, of all places, to the Back Bay Station in Boston and introduce yourself to one of the train captains. They'll be indicated with a sleeve, train captain sleeve on their arm, and tell them that you're one of the men that's going in the service. And who's sitting on the platform waiting for the train but Jimmy Keating?
From Natick also.
Yeah. And we became friends, just talking and so forth, the fact that we were both from Natick. And we were very, very close. And we sat beside each other for 7 days on that train going to our first assignment.
And where was that first assignment?
That was in Santa Ana, California. It's about 35 or 40 miles below Los Angeles, south of Los, between Los Angeles and San Diego, I guess, is the other city.
And what was it like when you went there? How many others were there with you?
It was almost impossible. There were 40,000 cadets there, and we didn't have any aircraft, of course. We were just being indoctrinated into the service, and it was mostly ground school, if they could find the place to, and an instructor to talk about airspeed and gunnery and different things associated with planes. And we stayed there probably for 2 or 3 months. And for the most part, we were doing a lot of like short order drill. We were give us like make believe rifles, and it's just it's a form of discipline that even today is kept very prevalent in whatever arm of the service you're in. There's something about it that builds discipline, I guess.
So you think that helped you in your life?
Oh, gee, to no end it did. Yes.
What did you like or dislike about your stay there in Santa Ana?
I think I liked the fact that I was always quite shy in school and speaking, of course. Since then, I've changed a little bit. But I made a host of new friends there, young men from, it seems though our train started in Back Bay in Boston, so there were a great number of young men from Newton, Wellesley, Natick, all over the place here in Massachusetts. And then the train stopped for a couple of days in Chicago, so that we had hundreds and hundreds of young men from the Midwest. They get on in Chicago, then it stopped in St. Louis. So these were the focal points for the young men that I made friends with. And up to that, I had pretty much been a loner. But now it was either get to know somebody, or it would be an awful, dull, and uninteresting time in the service.
So you made many friends from all areas of the U.S. going out to California?
Yes.
Okay. Did you receive any kind of advanced or specialized training beyond basic training?
Well, in the 2 or 3 months that we were there at Santa Ana, they determined whether you fell into one of three categories. You were either a pilot, or you were ready to become one, or you were a bombardier, or you were a navigator. Those were the three specifications. And I was determined, I had been singled out, not single because there were thousands of us, to become a pilot. Whereas Jimmy Keating was singled out to become a bombardier. Now he was already a college graduate from Holy Cross, I believe. And I don't know whether his math or college or whatever it was dictated what he was to become. I don't know, but maybe if you were a little more athletic and slight, they could tell them that you would be a good prospect to become a pilot.
So they said that you should be a bombardier. What was that going to entail in your service?
I was going to become a pilot.
A pilot, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That would mean that we would take different kinds of physical exercises to improve our response to things that would happen and needed quick decisions and so forth. Also, we were sent up to a place called Visalia, California, and that was considered the initial stage of becoming a pilot. And we were flying, and we had ground school, we had navigation instructors, and we had pilot instructors come in and teach us the fundamentals, really, of what happens in the air, and what keeps the plane up, and what keeps it down, different things.
So as a result of this, was this your specialty during the remaining part of your career?
It would have been the specialty for me to continue on and become a pilot. But unfortunately, in the third or fourth time that we were in a plane, the instructor and myself, we had a horrible accident. The plane flipped over. I don't know whether I was following him through with my feet on the rudders or what happened, but we were both badly injured. I had a fractured skull and was unconscious for a few days, and I lost track of him because he would be sent to a different medical facility than I was because I was in the service. And I remember it pained awfully, like a severe headache. So they took me over to another air base out of Visalia, over to Lemoore, California, which was larger and had access to different, more advanced medicine faculties. And apparently they sent for a surgeon to come up from Los Angeles, and he spoke to me, and I can remember him standing beside the bed and saying, if you do exactly what I tell you to do, you'll never have a headache. And I said, I'll do anything to get rid of this pain. He said, I want you to stay in bed for 30 days. And they made some kind of an operation in my back and took fluid out of. At any rate, I've never had a headache, and I was very grateful to him. Then I went back to Visalia, my home base. And of course, by that time, they had received information from the flight surgeon in Washington that anybody with a severe head injury would have to be grounded for a year. And that upset every plan that I ever had to become a pilot.
So what happened then?
They sent me home for 30 days, rest, R&R they called them. And in those 30 days were the longest, loneliest days of my life. I mean, I was at home with my mother and sister and so forth, but all my brothers were gone, and all my friends were gone on the service. And then I got letters from the Air Force saying that if I wished, I could get out of the service and consider my duty fulfilled. But I said, gee, I don't know if I want that. I said, I couldn't stay here for however long it takes. So I got back on the train and went back to Visalia, and they couldn't keep me there as a cadet because I wasn't a cadet any longer. So I went off to a place in Bakersfield. And you'll never know the string of events that happens sometimes. I was assigned to a lieutenant that had a little office and a few girls running around keeping records and things like that. And he received a teletype from the Air Force that indicated that if you had any cadets there that did not have fear of flying, would they be interested in flying with radar aircraft? And he asked me if I'd be interested in it. I had become friendly with him because by this time I was playing hockey for this Bakersfield Air Force team, and we were in a big private bus, and we were getting paid for it extra. Not that I'm that good a hockey player, but I was one of the few guys that had skates in place. I had sent home for them. Anyway, I took the lieutenant up on it, and the next station was Boca Raton in Florida, which was a long way from California. And there I was introduced to this new concept of radar and interceptions and landfalls and governing a host of things that could happen in a plane that could be controlled by radar if you knew how to operate it and how it functioned.
So when you were in Florida, you were in training to learn how to operate this system?
Yes.
And how long were you there for?
I think we were there for at least 2.5 or 3 months. We did not have any aircraft. Everything was ground duty and marching, and some of the more disinteresting things. Just keeping up your area in the barracks and so forth, and attending meetings and so.
And so this was cadet training that you were in?
At the time it was cadet, but would you believe that after a very few short weeks, they said, we can't have you men operating this secretive equipment at the rank that you're in. So we have to make you flight officers, which was a different kind of a rank. You were not a commissioned officer, but you had the same privileges. I mean, you were just right next to a second lieutenant. And what a marvelous deal that was. I mean, I went from working in this little office in California to Boca Raton, and I went from like corporal to a flight officer in just a matter of a few weeks, and enjoyed the same privileges as a regular lieutenant would, or a captain, or a major.
So along with your training and your accident then changing your career course to this new type of
brand
system,
new
radar. Did that take you overseas to Europe at all or to the Pacific?
Well, even though all of our final training was in California, but the fact that we had all come to Florida for this brand new instrument, now we were Floridians, so to speak. And we moved from one base to the other, from Boca Raton up to Orlando, and then Kissimmee and Dunellen. These places now, I guess, are part of Disney World.
And at the time, they were part of the branches
but
of the
service. At the time that I was there, any little town like Kissimmee or Dunellen or Ocala, where they have all the horses, that had a runway and a strip, that became a training field. And we were there, and they made me an instructor. I guess I took to it pretty kindly, and I don't mean to say that, but I mean, I was pretty good at it. And I could teach and inspire other guys, and that seemed to come natural to me. And I stayed there maybe 4 or 5 months. And then we were getting tired of it, and some of the pilots that used to take us up on our training missions, said, why don't we make a little squadron of our own with our own leader and our own officers. And so one of the top pilots in the training program, his name is Jimmy Thompson from California. He had already flown a whole mission, every single flight, in Great Britain. He was a member of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he was transferred to England, where he flew maybe 40 or 50, missions. And he asked me one day, he said, Joe, would you like to be my RO, that's radar observer, but you were more than a radar, you were a navigator. And you became so close that you could almost anticipate what the other man was going to do. And that's how they meant it to be. The pilot and the radar observer, or the pilot and the navigator, almost became one in your thoughts and words and recovering from emergencies and landings and gear up and things like that. And so we formed the 425th Night Fighter Squadron. And I became a member of that. And because Jimmy had a lot of experience, having been to England through a whole war already, he was designated as a flight leader pilot. And I automatically became a flight leader radar observer.
So you worked hand in hand with Jimmy Thompson?
Every single mission we flew together.
And where did they take you? Where did these missions take you to?
Well, by this time we were in England. That's kind of an interesting thing. The squadron went from Florida out to California again, back to, of all places, back to the same place where I had the accident, but at a different landing strip. And we were there for a couple of months doing odd kinds of things, air-to-ground gunnery and different things that you become adept at. Then we got on a train in the middle of the night and ended up at Camp Miles Standish down in Plymouth, of all places.
Plymouth, Massachusetts.
We were certain that we were going to go to New Guinea and fly against the Japanese in that particular sphinx of the war. But no, lo and behold, they brought us all the way back to Camp Miles Standish. And then again in the middle of the night, because of an army directive that says you're supposed to move troops under the cover of darkness. But there were hundreds of trucks there with all of us in them. And they took us to Boston Harbor, and we loaded on one huge vessel that had been the name of the vessel was the USS Brazil. And there were something like 8,000 or 9,000 soldiers on that ship. And it took us another maybe 5 to 7 days with all kinds of protection and submarines around us and things. And we landed in Liverpool, England. And would you believe that the very first thing that they issued us was a bicycle?
And why was that?
That was because there was a horrible gas ration in England. Everything was rationed. But the bicycles were just a method of getting around. You could go to a dance, or you could go from your barracks to wherever they are serving meals. And it has been said, I think, several times by some of the doctors that used to operate on the flyers that come back and either made a forced landing or landing without any wheels, or some of them were plucked from the English Channel. And the saying was that if you landed in the channel in the wintertime, you had 30 seconds to say a couple of prayers, because it was so cold that you were gone in that time. But these doctors said that because of the bicycles, the men were physically hardened and their stomachs were like leather, and that they could operate on them. And he said it was really a pleasure bringing these men back to life because they didn't have an ounce of flesh on them. And
so they were in such good shape.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you were issued a bike. Were you with Jimmy Thompson then, at that time also?
Every minute.
Okay. Did you have, when you talk about the 425th Night Fighter Squadron, tell us about that group. And were you stationed out of Liverpool?
No, from Liverpool we moved in, that's a seaport, of course. And we moved inland to, the first assignment was a place called Shami Down. Shami Down. It was in the bottom section of England, near Wales, I guess you'd say. And we were in Quonset huts. And they were very adequate. And we stayed there waiting patiently for D-Day to occur, when maybe we'd be called into France to set up bases over there. So we really didn't have any combat at all while we were there waiting for D-Day to happen, when thousands of men would have flown over, and everybody kind of knows what D-Day was like. But
now you talk about D-Day, that's what we know it as today. But you didn't know that ahead of time, did you?
No.
They didn't have a name
for
it. We
knew
that
sometime there was going to be a landing.
Yes.
In France.
Right.
We didn't know, but because Eisenhower and all the big generals were trying to pick a good time, and they had hundreds of planes ready, and they had a lot of gliders that were towed behind other aircraft and just cut loose. And they crash-landed those in France. It was a very interesting time. We didn't stay long at this Shami Down before we were moved away up to Scotland, up near Glasgow or one of those places. But almost as far north as you could go in the British Isles. And as yet we had no missions. We didn't even have our planes yet.
Was that frustrating to you?
Yes.
So how did you fill your days?
Maybe reading dime novels or riding around on our bicycles and different kinds of things. Maybe playing a little baseball if we could find some equipment. But and there was a lot of reading, and the food was basic and not too bad.
Did you hear about other aspects of the war and what was happening? Did you hear about that from any?
I remember that question, and for some reason I really didn't. I was concerned about maybe where my brothers might be. We had a couple of very interesting events there. I don't know if there'd be, if I'm using too much time on
that. Not at all, go right ahead.
When we did get our aircraft, they had been shipped to Ireland, and then we reassembled there, taken off the vessels, reassembled, and we sent the pilots over to Ireland to bring our planes back. And that was a great day for us when they came in and started landing, because now we were associated with a plane. And some of the more outspoken pilots and ROs had their names emblazoned on the side of the plane before they even had any combat, so to speak. But we had an interesting situation happen to both Jimmy Thompson, the pilot, and myself. When somebody was using our plane for some purpose, and they had inadvertently raised the wheels with the engines running. And of course, what happens then is that they call it sudden stoppage. The engines almost come out of their brackets and they have to be changed. We were very upset over that because it was kind of a personal thing with us to have our own plane, but now it was damaged. So they put new engines in it, and we had to have what they call slow time on them. So Jimmy and I took one up one day, one of our P-61s. Well, it was fully loaded with cannons and machine guns and everything. But we would fly it just around getting the engines acclimated to doing their service again. And during this time, Jimmy said to me, "Joe, would you like to fly it for a little bit?" Well, because I had flown some little planes, but this was a big twin-engine bomber, so to speak. And it wasn't built for changing from one man up front to... So it took him a long time to get out of his seat and me a long time to get in. And he had left the plane on what they call automatic pilot. So when I get in and started maneuvering and flying and going up and down and stuff like that, it was extremely difficult for me to move the controls, because it was still on automatic pilot. He never turned it back. So I said, "Jimmy, you better get back in here because I'm worn out. I don't see how you do it." And so he soon discovered the problem. And by that time, we had run into difficulty beyond the engines. We seemed to have lost something that would help us break the plane. We played around with it too long, and now it became a danger. And we were way down flying over France. And Jimmy said, "We better find a place to put this thing down fast." Because I guess he had lights on, coming on, that indicated he was low on fuel. So we searched and searched, and out of the corner of his eye, he says, "What's that down there?" And there was a landing strip. And at the end of the landing strip, they had piled snow up. It was in the wintertime, and they had plowed the snow off the regular runway into a big pile, as big as a house. And Jimmy said, "Let's see if we can hit at the beginning of that, and maybe the snow will help stop us." And we went into that snow pile at least 75 miles an hour. And the propellers were throwing the snow. I mean, it was a miracle that plane finally stopped right at the end of the runway, surrounded by this deep snow. And now we had caused more problems than the two engines, because we had to have mechanics sent all the way down the south of France to get this plane back on its wheels again. We didn't make very many friends with the higher-ups in our squadron.
Did it also make you think about your first experience in your accident in California? Were you nervous at all about that?
I completely forgot about that somehow or other. With this new, and you know, as strange as it may sound, a lot of the pilots that were with me in our very first assignment out in California were from Newton, Wellesley, and I got to know a lot of them. Some of them later were working for the Boston Herald. Later another man was a selectman up in Tewksbury or something, and we were all good friends. Then they became involved in the night fighter program as pilots. So when they came through the door for their very first assignment, who was there sitting waiting for them, already with the same rank that they had, and I had left them months ago.
So it was like a reunion, and they must have been a
surprise.
I mean,
how things happen to people, sure. It's surprising.
So was your duties to literally fly at night using radar?
Yes.
And so after your accident in France, did you see more evenings and flight scheduling?
Somehow or other you get hardened to it. And we started flying again, and you get back on the flight board, so to speak. And Jimmy and I were always the first two names on the flight and the arrow for a number of missions. And we were kind of proud of that, because we never canceled out on a flight. And some of the reasons that young men would come back in and tell the colonel that I can't go because my knee got cold or something. I mean, some ridiculous excuse, really. Because we lost a lot of young men.
You did.
You know, you're real close people to you that were, for some reason, just didn't come back.
So you would be back waiting for some of the squadron to come back. Would you hear ahead of time that maybe one of the planes or some of the men were lost? Would you hear this via radio from other pilots?
We would hear it generally when we came down, because we maintained kind of silence when we were flying. But one of the most dangerous aspects of night flying, and you'd be surprised what you can see at night, particularly with railroad tracks. They gleam in the night if there's a moon, and it helps you follow them into marshalling yards, which used to be one of our favorite targets, because we had big 360-gallon napalm auxiliary tanks hung under each wing. Now, I don't know if you know what napalm is, but it's a fluid that when it contacts itself on the ground, when it's dropped from a plane, it burns with such an intensity that a locomotive would just be a ball of steel if this thing came near it. And railroad tracks just twist up like ribbons. So that marshalling yards used to be one of our favorite targets. If you could slip in there a couple of times, or at once, don't make the second trip, because that's the one when you kind of yell it sometimes.
From the enemy.
Well, one of the worst things about the marshalling yards is that they would protect them with balloons. And the balloons were just like a dirigible. But coming down from them and attached to the ground was a steel cable. You don't know that the cable is there. And if you're making another run or something and you run into one of those cables, it cuts your wing right in half. And you don't come back from that mission.
And did you see that occur occasionally? Was that difficult for you? How old were you at that point in time?
I think I went in the service when I was 23. Mm-hmm. Because I got called, you can ask.
Go ahead.
I got called back into the Korean War. I was home for 4 years. But I had signed the Air Force Reserve, I guess they called them. I think I mentioned it there. And I don't know why I did it. It just seemed to be the thing to do. And those 4 years were kind of lost for me, because I wasn't disturbed, but I just didn't have any directive.
When you came back from World War II?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we were released at some big base down south, an infantry base. And there we were given an option of signing up for the reserve, or maybe staying in the service and maybe taking a chance on additional duty against Japan. But I had enough of it. So I got out and came home.
But did you sign up for the reserve at that point in time? Okay. And so that sign up was a stipulation that perhaps when needed they would call you back up?
Exactly.
Okay, so you came home to Natick?
I did.
And what did you do for those 4 years?
Well, I had been working for the phone company, and I went back to them, and they made it very pleasant for us. We could choose our own place of work, and they put you back in at the same level that you had before. They had these competitive exams that enable you to improve your situation, and not only placement-wise, but money-wise. And I took these exams, and there were three of them. So I could go to a place like Brookline, for example, and I could be all alone in this big building, and presumably anything that happened, I could fix it. I couldn't always, but the exams told them I could. And I took those during the 4 years, but it was a lackadaisical back and forth to Brookline and using old cars and not having enough money for a new car, but it was a non-productive era, other than the exams and the phone company, of course. And then one day, in the mail came this letter from Washington. And the initial phrase on the front line was, we are indeed fortunate to have men like you still under the reserve clause. So they said that they were trying to beef up the Air Force flight program, particularly the radar, airborne radar, and that you would be welcomed back on a certain date and help set up a school. I was sent down to Florida, and that was a wonderful 2 years because it seemed as though anything was a release from the disparaging 4 years that we stumbled around the phone company and Natick. And
did you find that other friends felt the same way when they got back from the war, that they kind of stumbled around also?
I think it was a general feeling. I mean, I don't think we spoke about it to one another, but you could almost tell when we finally met up again. And of course, once again, we were thrown in with all our old friends. And it was a great 2 years down. We were sent to Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, which is on the panhandle part of Florida. And we were welcomed every place. We joined a beautiful country club for, I think, $60 a year or something. And we had lockers, and you could leave your shoes out after golf, and they'd be polished the next day, and that kind of a setup.
Were you single at the time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you went through this training or upgrading the program, helping to upgrade their program. You said it was a 2-year program. And then what?
I think when the program started, I had met a girl from Vermont, and we were quite enamored of each other. So I took a diamond up to Vermont with me one day, and she said, yes. This was around Christmas, I think, of 1950. And then within a week or so, the letter arrived from Washington calling me back in the service. So I did go back in 1951. We went back in the service maybe within a couple of months. Then I came home in 1951 in June and got married, and went back down with my new bride to finish out the 2 years. And that was a kind of a laid-back, wonderful experience because of there was music and dances, and there was no fear either of getting involved in the Japanese conflict because that had ended. And it was just, everything was kind of phasing out, so to speak. And I said to my wife one day when we came home, I said, you know, I've heard so much about degrees and college. I said, I'm sick of it. I've had it right up to here. Because I could see men getting bypassed for inferior people being put into different jobs during that two-year period. And I said, I think I'll go to college. Well, she was a college graduate, and she was teaching part-time here in Natick. And she said, you don't know what you're saying. She said, you know, you just don't say I'm going to go to college. But I made application down at Babson, and that was a great, we did the 4 years and 3 years then. They don't do it anymore, I guess. But we went Saturday mornings, and we went, I think we almost went Easter. The only holiday we recognized was Christmas.
Were you one of the older individuals in the class?
I was 33 years old.
Were you really?
Yeah, I can remember getting up in a speech class, public speaking, and I was so shy, still. But they taught me differently at Babson in a short time. They had a public speaking course in every single semester, maybe two or three semesters a year. And I can remember my initial little talk was, you know, I'm 33 years old, and I really don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm going to try. And was that right? Yeah, and I graduated in 1956.
What was your degree?
My degree was in finance.
And then did you get a job in finance after that?
Beg pardon?
Did you get a job in finance after that?
No, I continued on with the telephone company in sort of a blue-collar job. But the system they had then, that if you had any further education or any reason to believe that you were misplaced because of your background in education, you wrote a letter to the management. In it you told them or asked them why you should have a different assignment, because now I'm Roger Babson, or now I'm different. And it wasn't a menial job, but it was a blue collar job, no advancement any further. So they moved me into Boston, and I did interviewing, and I really loved that, because we were expanding, and all the new young men coming home from the service wanted to get with the telephone company, and you interviewed them and wrote up your opinion of them and things like that. Then I moved into accounting, where they were changing these huge operations that were manual with hundreds of young ladies doing things that could be done like that with a computer. And that's when I moved into accounting and into computer work, and that's what I did for the next several years.
And while you were doing that work, were you back here living in Natick? Did you settle down here in Natick?
Yes, we rented a house, another house, an apartment on West Central Street, well, the same street that I live on today, so I got to know people along the way. And as I say, my wife was there with me, and we had two boys by this time. And these were the years that I was going to Babson, and that's all I did was go to Babson. I didn't take out the refuse. I didn't vacuum the living room rug. All I did was study and work. But in 3 years, we graduated. And then things started to pick up. Then I moved ahead in the phone company. And
did you go to Babson on a GI Bill? You did. You got financing.
They were great.
That's
wonderful.
When you look back on your career, and by the way, I didn't ask you, you were discharged initially from the service late 40s, was that?
Yes.
And what was your rank when you were discharged?
My rank when I was discharged the first time was a first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. But the second time, after the Korean War, when I was discharged then, I was a captain.
Captain. When you first came home from World War II, what were your feelings about coming home? How did you feel about what you had experienced, what you had been through, and then coming back? Did you have good sense?
It seemed to me, I guess, as though there was a lot of work yet to be done with your family and maybe finding a home. I mean, at the time we were renting, and even though we had just finished Babson and so forth, everything was kind of at a standstill. I was with the phone company and had a good job and there were wonderful possibilities. But there was a yearning there to get on with life. I know I was probably, as I say, I was 33 years old when I finished Babson, and I had lost a great segment of production that other people might enjoy because of the intervention of the service requirements. But
when you came home, did you join any veterans organizations?
Yeah.
What did you join?
The Legion.
You joined the Legion.
Mm-hmm. Since then, I have joined the Elks. That's kind of a mature Legion, I guess. We have a wonderful group of guys up there. We have three or four different golf levels of, and you can play anytime and invited, and you feel welcome.
Do you attend any of reunions or see any of your old mates that you were in the service with?
That's a big abyss in my life. I wish I could have done more of that. Yes, I did. I love the reunions. We went to Vegas, Los Angeles, Washington, down to Florida again, and it was nice. I mean, you felt good at the reunions because you know that you did your part.
How important to you was serving in the military?
The service experience?
Yes. How important?
Well, very important. Probably the most important thing I did in my life, other than maybe go to Babson, but that was a personal thing for self-acclaim. The service, you were putting it on the line.
And how do you feel it affected your life? I know earlier in this interview you mentioned the discipline that it gave you throughout your life. What else? What other sense do you feel how it might have affected your life?
Well, you learned in life that things really don't get done by themselves. If there's something to accomplish, I mean, if you have to take a child to the doctor for some maybe distasteful result, you just kind of grin and bear it, and you do it. And there were times like before the service or in between the service that you were might become not a scofflaw, but you would just pass it over as not being important right now. But it is important to get things done on time. It's hard to say. There was kind of a roadblock there I'd like to mention. I don't know if it will help anybody or not, but with coming back from the service and the parties and the reunions and things like that, alcohol became a very kind of a lean-to for me to go on. And it's a devilish addiction, really, and can creep up on you. So I did take hold of that. And a doctor called me one day on the phone and said, "Jill, are you drinking?" And like all good liars, you say, "Yeah, a little bit." But you might have been drinking more than you thought. And he said, "We have a program up here at Leonard Morris, 10-day program." He said, "It might do you some good." He said, "Your insurance will cover it." And he said, "Why don't you look into that?" I said, "Can you help me with that, doctor? Can you get me in there?" He said, "Yes, I can, because I'm the physician in charge." But he said, "We don't do it that way. You have to go up and introduce yourself to the man that runs the program and see if it's for you." And I looked down my nose at all those people up there and said, "I don't belong here with you people." But I did belong. And in 10 days, it was the best 10 days I've ever spent in my life. And that was 23 years ago. And I haven't had one single can of beer or a drop of alcohol since.
That must make you very,
that
very
makes
proud.
A big difference.
Sure.
In your accomplishments in life and getting things done. And your self-esteem, you don't do it for the other guy. You do it for yourself.
That's right. Before we wind down, I have a few other questions.
Okay.
Looking back, what was one of the most memorable experiences in your military career? One of the things I will prompt you on is you mentioned to me buzz bombs in France. Tell me about that quickly.
Somewhere along the line before D-Day, which is June 42, the Germans came up with a device where they made a little, it was kind of, they manufactured a small plane, and the plane had its own engine, and they could launch it out of a pad. And it also had about 2,000 pounds of explosive. And they knew, they didn't know exactly where it was going to land, but it was headed for London and other big cities. This was before D-Day, so that everything in France and Holland and Luxembourg was still German occupied. So they sent 5 planes from our squadron down to Ford, England, which is a great big air base, right on the English Canal. And there were, we had tremendous response from radar-operated people that were operating radar stations on the ground, and they could see these bombs coming. And we, under their control, would be flying, trying to knock them down before they got to London. And I'm telling you, that was some experience. Because if the buzz bomb could, they used to come over at about 400 miles an hour. And we couldn't travel that fast, but we could go 300 or 350. But if we were 5,000 feet above them and you dive down and come up behind them, then you had a pretty good chance of hitting them. And they had a tail and fuselage just like a regular little plane. And if you could hit some of those controls with some of our cannons that we had 20 millimeter, they call them ATI, high explosive incendiary. In other words, as it's shooting out of the cannons, you can see every fifth or sixth shell would be lighted. And you could see it hit something because it would explode. And therefore the pilot would know exactly where his shots were landing. But you didn't have much time because the canal is only about 26 miles wide. And we were flying up over France and Holland and Germany trying to spot where these things were coming from. That was the important part, to find the launching pad, and we never did find it. They had several, of course. But on two occasions, we got them. We came down behind them, and the ground control radar kept saying, turn back, turn back. We'll take care of it here. And they threw up shrouds of curtains of shells to intercept this buzz bomb. They didn't want us anyplace near it because we could get hit too. And Jimmy had control of the can of the guns on the regular steering shaft. But he had no idea how far this was because it was like a big red ball in front of you. That was the buzz bomb with its own engine driving it towards London. But I could tell how far it was because I could pick it up on my radar scope. So that if you could get it, say, within 700 feet, 600 feet, 800 feet or something, you had a chance. But with those people screaming in your ears, say, turn back, turn back. And Jimmy yelling at me, how far is it now? What are we? You get gray pretty fast.
I'll bet you do.
Anyway, it started drawing away from us. And I told Jimmy, I said, if you're going to get it, you better get it right now because we're losing it. And he hit it all around it and he dumped it right in front of a big hotel on the beach. And we got credit for that one. It's on our inclination, it's on our discharge papers. That was a horrible experience, but
the end result in this case something that, was yes, helpful.
When you get in the middle of something like that, you, with your training and your enthusiasm, you go through with it.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
What about a memorable character?
The what?
A memorable character, someone that you met that you kind of don't forget.
Well, when we get on the train in Boston, Jimmy Keating and myself, there was a young man there by the name of Armand. He was he was from the Far East, I think. But he was willing to be a good soldier, and he kind of took to Jimmy and I, and we visited, and we became a threesome. And we kept writing to one another and kept in touch and so forth. And we all went our separate ways. Jimmy was in B-17s and he got shot down on his third mission and was a prisoner of war for some time in Germany. But because he was already a Holy Cross graduate, I remember he had a ring and they liked the ring and they liked Jimmy. He was in charge of calisthenics and things. But this Armand, when I finally, on the last day of my last mission, Jimmy and I were ready to go. We had studied all afternoon about maps and things because we were stationed at the same base as the P-47s. And they were fighters. They would fly in the daytime and fly against the bridges and whatever else they could shoot up. Then they'd come back and tell all the information that they had found during the day to their intelligence officers. And then that information would be available to us for night flying. And we used to take off maybe 6:30 or 7 at night, and our missions only lasted a couple of hours. That's all the fuel we had. But in that time, we tried to damage trucks and things like that, and railroad stations and barges and anything that moved you could shoot up. So Jimmy and I finished our missions ahead of everybody else. So we were getting ready to go on. We didn't know it was our last mission, but we were ready to go, and the colonel came out in a Jeep. And with our engines running, he got out in front of our plane in the Jeep, and he got out, and he made a motion to cut your throat. which meant in the Air Force, stop the engines. So Jimmy says, I wonder what he wants. So we stopped the engines and climbed down, and he looked up through the hatches and he said, we just got a directive from headquarters. You people are all done. You've flown enough. And boy, you can imagine how that sounded. He said, there's a bottle of gin or something in my room under the bed. He said, it's yours. He said, I'll see you when I get back. And on the way back, Jimmy and I were stopped at this great big kind of a marshalling base for people going back to the United States. You think that they would have flown us back, but they didn't. They put us on Liberty ships that went way up in the air. And one morning I heard this voice giving instructions for calisthenics. And I said, Jimmy, you know who that is? That's Armand. And it was. It was the same.
Here's your friend Armand.
And we had a great reunion, the three of us. He had somehow or other had washed out of what he was destined to do, but he was still there working, trying to be a good soldier, but not doing what he had been trained to do.
So all three of you started out together, and then as you were finishing up, you were together.
Finished up. Although Jimmy and I came home on that Liberty ship, Armand stayed there giving instructions, and he used to have a box that he stood on because he was short and dark, but he was a very fine person.
Is there anything else as we finish this up? Any comments you'd like to make, whether it be to your family or to people viewing this tape? Anything you'd like to share with us? Anything finishing up here?
Well, I can't leave well enough alone because I tell all my friends, I said I'm going to be interviewed and the time and the date and everything down at the library about what went on during, you know, my military career. And they're all teasing me about it and so forth. But underneath, I think they were kind of jealous. But at any rate, I'd embellish it a little bit and tell some stories here and there. And that's why I said, I hope that if they get a DVD or something like that, they won't believe that I won the war all by myself, which is not true. I mean it.
You had a lot of help.
Yeah.
And you made a lot of friends.
I did.
And we would like to thank you today, Joseph E. Downey. Thank you for coming in and sharing some very remarkable stories with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.